Let us read together in 2 Samuel chapter 1. 2 Samuel chapter 1. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had abode 2 days in Ziklag. It came even to pass on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul, with his clothes rent and earth upon his head. And so it was when he came to David that he fell to the earth and did obeisance. And David said unto him, From whence comest thou? And he said unto him, Out of the camp of Israel am I escaped. And David said unto him, How went the matter? I pray thee, tell me. And he answered, That the people are fled from the battle, and many of the people also are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also. And David said unto the young man that told him, How knowest thou that Saul and Jonathan his son be dead? And the young man that told him said, As I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear, and lo, the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called unto me, and I answered, Here am I. And he said unto me, Who art thou? And I answered him, I am an Amalekite. He said unto me again, Stand, I pray thee, upon me and slay me, for anguish has come upon me, because my life is yet whole in me. So I stood upon him and slew him, because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head and the bracelet that was on his arm, and have brought them hither unto my lord. And David took hold on his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until even for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. And David said unto the young man that told him, Whence art thou? And he answered, I am the son of a stranger, an Amalekite. And David said unto him, How wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? And David called one of the young men and said, Go near and fall upon him. And he smote him that he died. And David said unto him, Thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth hath testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed. And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. Also he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher, The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thine high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of woman. How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished? Amen. May God bless to us that reading of his own holy word. Let us turn again to 2 Samuel chapter 1. 2 Samuel 1 and verse 20. Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. How would you react if your greatest enemy was to die and you were to inherit all that he had? Or how would you react if, maybe not a personal enemy, but say the greatest enemy of the gospel, of the Christian church, died, and all that he had was to pass into the hands of the godly? Perhaps the temptation would be to have a celebration and to rejoice openly and loudly and publicly. Or maybe, while the sentiments be the same, yet we do it silently. We silently and privately rejoice and are glad at such a death. Well, this was not how David reacted when his and the church's greatest enemy died. When Saul, the king of Israel, died gruesomely and awfully in battle. His reaction was twofold. It was to lament and to learn. It was to lament over Saul and to learn, or rather more, to teach Israel how to use the bow. So there was a spiritual side to his reaction, and there was a very practical, down-to-earth reaction. He saw Israel badly defeated. And so we read here, verse 17, David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son, and he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. So he sees a need for training and warfare so that they be not defeated again. But he also sees that there are spiritual lessons to learn. That's a wonderful, balanced reaction of a godly man. We'd like to look this afternoon at some of the spiritual lessons that David draws from this tragic death of King Saul. We'd like to look at four of the phrases in particular that make up this lament, this sad song. First of all, notice in verse 19, at the end of it, how are the mighty fallen? And this is a phrase he repeats in 25 and again in 27. How are the mighty fallen? Now he's thinking, of course, of Saul. Saul was a mighty man. He was made mighty by God. He wasn't mighty by birth. And he was taken really from obscurity and he was made mighty. God gave him beauty. He was handsome. God gave him courage. God gave him the throne. God gave him popularity. God gave him success. God gave him his spirit, not savingly, but he gave him his spirit in order to give him gifts that he needed for this important role of ruling over Israel. In fact, so much of the Holy Spirit did Saul have that he even prophesied with the sons of the prophets, we read. It's a remarkable and unusual situation. A man with so much of the Spirit endowing him with gifts, but not with grace. Working on him, as it were, but not working in him. In fact, Saul had even more than that. He was given godly friends, David, singing psalms to him in his palace. He was given prophets. He was given so much. He was made mighty. He was a mighty man. But he didn't stay mighty. As David notes here, how are the mighty fallen? And this wasn't a sudden crash. This was a gradual decline from bad to worse to worst. You'll remember in 1 Samuel 13, he was supposed to wait for Samuel to come to sacrifice before going into battle. But he ran out of patience and Saul went and sacrificed himself, which he should never have done. He was rebuked by Samuel. Did he learn the lesson? No. 2 chapters later, he does exactly the same thing. He does not heed the voice of the Lord. In 1 Chronicles 10:13, which reviews his life, we're told Saul died for his transgression which he committed against the Lord, even against the word of the Lord, which he kept not. He was given the word. He was given his role, and it wasn't to be a priest, and it wasn't to sacrifice. But Saul, we're told, he sinned against that word. So he's up here, and he starts falling. One act of disobedience. Warned. And then another act of disobedience. Warned, in fact told, the kingdom is departing from you. But he does something even worse than disobey and disregard the word of the Lord. He actually goes to seek wisdom from a medium, from a witch. He tries to contact the dead. 1 Chronicles 10 says this too. He sinned against the Lord by not keeping his word and also for asking counsel of one that had a familiar spirit, an evil spirit, an ability, real or pretend, to consult the dead. This is a mighty man who's gradually, bit by bit, weakening, becoming smaller and more insignificant. Until finally here, his last battle in 1 Samuel 31 is ended by the arrow of God. And so David looks back over this man's life and he says, how, oh how are the mighty fallen from such a height, from such position and such privilege to such a depth. How are the mighty fallen. The wheels of God grind slowly, but they grind exceeding small. The mighty have fallen because God has made him to fall, has brought him down as a punishment of his disobedience. And so we find him in 1 Samuel 31. He's wounded in verse 3. And he says to his armor bearer, "Draw thy sword and thrust me through, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me." You see, here's Saul. He's wounded. He's dying. He knows he's dying. And what's he concerned with? Is he thinking of eternity? Is he thinking of his soul? Is he thinking, "I'm about to face judgment. I need every second I've got to pray and plead for mercy. I've got to think about how God will perceive me." No, none of these things. What's in his mind is, "Draw thy sword and thrust me through, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me." He says, don't let it be known that King Saul was killed by a Philistine. And let me die, lest they come and torture and defile and tear up my body. See what his concerns are? It's his body and it's his reputation. Not his soul. And not his imminent judgment before God. How are the mighty fallen? His armor bearer doesn't do it, wouldn't do it. He was afraid to do it. Therefore we read in verse 4, 1 Samuel 31, Saul took a sword and fell upon it. And yet we're told in the passage we read of this Amalekite young man who said he came across Saul still breathing. And really this looks like a fuller account of what we have in 1 Samuel 31. So he's wounded. He then falls on his sword to hasten his death and still doesn't accomplish it. And you think, surely then he's going to want every second, every moment. He's still got a hope of mercy. He's not passed from time to eternity. But no, he sees this Amalekite coming past. And he says in verse 9, "Come and slay me, for anguish has come upon me, because my life is still whole in me." So this young Amalekite comes and slays him. Saul, was he thinking, that will be the end of my sufferings? Whereas it was really just the beginning. It was really just the beginning. And this is what David has in mind. It's not just the natural fall, the fall from king to slaughtered and wounded on the mountain of Gilboa. But that's a big fall. David is thinking above all of his fall into the depths of hell. A greatly privileged man. And now a greatly punished man. Because he knew not the Lord. How are the mighty fallen? And we can look through history. All the mighty fall, don't they? Hitler. Stalin. Mao Zedong. Saddam Hussein. All the mighty evil fall. It doesn't matter how high they rise. And even the mighty good. Those who are given position and power and place and popularity if they die without the Lord. Again, how have the mighty fallen? Friends, it doesn't matter where we ascend to in this world, what position and place and privilege we are given. If we disobey the word of the Lord, if we do not put our trust in His word and His Saviour, then however high we rise here, we will go to a great depth in the world to come. And many who understand spiritual things will come to your graveside. And whatever fancy words may be spoken in eloquent eulogy, yet those with spiritual knowledge will be standing saying, how have the mighty fallen? How have the mighty fallen? Will that be said of you? It need not be so. If we fall in our own estimation and fall before God, if we abase ourselves and humble ourselves before Him, however we are viewed in the eyes of the world, and if we plead for mercy, then we're promised that He will raise us up in spirit and into heaven itself through Jesus Christ. And in heaven, will it not be said, how have the weak risen? How have the nothings become something? How have the poor become rich? All through and only through the salvation of Jesus Christ. How have the mighty fallen? Then secondly, we'd like to look at the phrase we find in verse 20, chapter 1. Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ascalon. Gath was the capital of one of the Philistine regions, Achish. And Ascalon was where the main temple was to their idols. And really we've got an awful scene here. It's rather gruesome. At the end of chapter 31, we read the Philistines came across the body of Saul. And they stripped him. They cut off his head, verse 9. They stripped off his armor. They sent into the land of the Philistines round about to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. They put his armor in the house of Ashtaroth. They fastened his body to the wall of Beth-shan. They stripped him. They decapitated him. They put his armor in their heathen idol temple. They took his head and put it in the house of Dagon, we're told in Chronicles. And they sent out word around the whole nation of what they had done to Saul, published it. And we read here of David hearing of this terrible reproach that's come upon the Lord's anointed and therefore, by extension, the Lord's people upon Israel. He's seeing the heathen rejoicing and celebrating this great victory. And it's an agony for him. It's paining him to his soul. And he's saying, oh, that it would stop being told in Gath, and that the streets of Ascalon would no longer be hearing of these terrible things that have happened to God's anointed and God's people, because they're rejoicing and they're triumphing. Tell it not in Gath. Something terrible has happened here in the people of God. And David's anxiety is that the world not make hay out of it, that the world not make something out of it that they can triumph with. Tell it not in Gath. And that again is such a godly sentiment. It's similar to the words we find in Proverbs. Hatred stirreth up strife, but love covereth all sins. He that covereth a transgression seeketh love, but he that repeateth a matter separateth very friends. Now, you know, you'd have thought maybe in David's position, who'd been so wronged by Saul, that he would be wanting, well, let's let everybody know Saul has fallen. Look what happens to those who fight against David. See, David is now to be king and to inherit all, and Saul, well, look at him. But no, David's not like that. Even though he was an ungodly man, yet he was within the external covenant of God. He was given a place by God. He was given an office by God. He was anointed with the oil of God. He even had the Spirit of God upon him. And as far as the Philistines were concerned, he was one of God's. And this was why they were so exulting over his fall. David, tell it not in Gath. I'd like to think on this, first of all, what it doesn't mean. This phrase and this idea of love covering transgression has actually been abused in the church at times. What does this not mean? Well, it doesn't mean we are to be blind to the fault, the sinful faults of others, and just kid on as if there's nothing wrong with anyone, any time, any place. Doesn't mean that. And neither does it mean that there is to be no such thing as church discipline. That when there is sin in the church, it's just to be covered up, not dealt with. Matthew 18 tells us that there is a procedure to follow. Neither does it mean that specific sins and even specific sinners are not to be publicly rebuked at times for their sins. In 1 Timothy 5, verse 20, the Apostle Paul says, "Them that sin rebuke before all, that others also may fear." Neither does this mean that when crime is committed within the church, that it shouldn't be reported to the authorities appointed by God. And neither does it mean that when things go wrong in the church, that the church should try and spin doctor their way out of it and put a gloss on it and try and make everything look great when it's not great at all. And many have tried to use this kind of idea and these kinds of phrases, tell it not in Gath, to do these very things. To just ignore faults, to neglect church discipline, to excuse them not publicly rebuking sin, to prevent the reporting of serious crime to the relevant authorities, and to justify spinning bad news for the church into good news. Doesn't mean these things. What does it mean? Tell it not in Gath. What's David's aim here? Well, surely, first of all, it's saying we shouldn't give extra and easy ammunition to the enemies of God to fire against the church. It also means that we should grieve over the public sins of the church, and even the downfall of figures in the church, even of people, are they not within our own circles? Whether they are converted or not, televangelists and others are associated with the Church of Christ, and it gives ammunition to the enemies of the gospel. And we should grieve over those professing Christians and ministers, their terrible moral falls. It also means we should be very careful about what we talk about in front of the world, that we're not washing the church's dirty linen in front of the world all the time. It means also we should be very careful about speaking of the problems and the faults of Christians and of the church in front of our unconverted family members. Tell it not in Gath. This should be the spirit of the godly person. Let's try and do all that we legitimately and properly can to prevent ammunition falling into the hands of the enemy so that they can triumph over the Christian and over the Christian church. Tell it not in Gath. This used to be a very common phrase in the Scottish Highlands, when, say, one of the Christians fell into sin, the older ones would say to one another, if ever it was raised, they would say, tell it not in Gath. Tell it not in Gath. Don't multiply the matter. Don't magnify the matter. Don't publicize the matter unnecessarily. Tell it not in Gath. Then thirdly here, the third phrase is in verse 21. Let there be no dew. David turns to nature. And he invites, in fact, he invites all of nature to lament and mourn with him. He says, you mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew. Neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. He's looking out at Gilboa and he sees that these are fertile areas with crops and with cattle and sheep that might be used for sacrifice. And he says, of these areas, let them have no dew and let them have no rain. In other words, he wants to see God's disapproval and curse upon these areas. He wants to see them made barren and empty and arid and desert. Why? Because, he says, there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul as though he had not been anointed with oil. He's saying Saul has been treated as though he was just something cursed by God and man. It was as if they'd never had the privilege of being anointed with oil. And so he's looking at this area and he's seeing it as an area where terrible spiritual disaster has happened and terrible spiritual dishonor has occurred. I can't imagine David rather, this was a place where God had been dishonored. God's church had been degraded. And he's saying, let that be obvious. and let not there be any blessing of God upon that place ever again. And is this not also a sentiment of the godly man, the godly woman, godly boy or girl? We can look back in our lives and we can think of places where we dishonoured God, where we either spoke or did sinful things. We don't want to go back there. Personally, I can think of my growing up as a teenager in the south of Glasgow. I've had opportunity at times to go back and see the old haunts, as they say. See the old school and playing fields and tennis courts and lanes and fields. I can't do it. I can't bear hardly even to think of these places, because these were my mountains of Gilboa. These were the places where I dishonoured God. We think perhaps of public places where God is dishonoured. Think maybe of the cinema, the movies, where day by day and night by night, God's name and God's cause is mocked and disgraced. These are mountains of Gilboa. Let there be no dew. Let there be no rain. Let not $1 walk out of my pocket into the pockets of those who own such places. There are mountains of Gilboa in this world, and our sentiment should be, let there be no dew, let there be no rain, let these places fall into disrepair, let them be destroyed, and let God's disapproval of these places be made manifest and known. Like to look at the fourth phrase after. However the mighty fallen, tell it not in Gath. Let there be no dew. And fourthly, in verse 24, weep over Saul, ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul. We wouldn't be surprised to read, weep over Jonathan. Jonathan, who was a spiritual brother to David, the son of Saul, and he does express distress for that loss in verse 26. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of woman. He had a spiritual relationship with Jonathan, which was now over for a time anyway. And he is distressed. But he doesn't here command weeping over Jonathan. Instead, he turns to Israel and he says, weep over Saul. The ungodly Saul, the fallen Saul. Weep over Saul. And this was genuine. This wasn't crocodile tears, as we say. If you look at what happened when the Amalekite told David,
Of Saul's death, we read in verse 11, David took hold in his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him, and they mourned and wept and fasted until even for Saul and for Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. Now here David starts the period of official mourning. Weep over Saul. Why was he weeping? Well, interestingly, the focus of the weeping here is on Saul's natural qualities. David wept over Saul partly because of natural relationship. He was his king. He was his father-in-law. He was his best friend's father. He was also, though, as he highlights here, a good soldier. We read, for example, in verse 22, from the blood of the slain and from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Verse 23, we read of Saul and Jonathan fighting together, not divided in their death, swifter than eagles and stronger than lions. He has great courage, great military skill and bravery. And he celebrates this and laments over Israel's loss of it. And then he goes further and he laments over the fact that Saul enriched Israel. He had fought for Israel and he enriched Israel. He says, "Ye daughters of Israel, 24, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel." So he was a defender of Israel and he was an enricher of Israel. This is part of his lament, and it warrants us to lament over the loss of natural relationships and the natural gifts, the gifts given even to unconverted men and women. To lament over the loss of such when they die. But it's still pretty empty, isn't it? I'm sure we've all been at funerals or in mourning houses and you have to rack your brains and you have to rack history to try and find something commendable. And even when you do and you find something natural, something on the human level that was commendable, you still feel it's hollow, still empty. Is that it? In Saul's case, that was it. But David wasn't only lamenting over the loss of natural relationship and natural gifts. He was lamenting over where Saul was. He thought, no doubt, of how Saul suffered in life and how Saul suffered in death. But what he's thinking of now is how Saul is suffering in hell and for eternity. Weep. Weep over Saul. That's appropriate. Though weeping can change nothing, it's still appropriate. It's spiritually beneficial to humble ourselves and pray and to feel the sorrow and the sadness and the tragedy of the death of an unconverted friend or family member. It's not to be hard-hearted and say, well, that was what they deserved. True enough, but still weep over Saul. And surely here we see the heart of the man after God's own heart. Here we see the heart of God in the heart of David. Here we see David weeping retrospectively, looking back and weeping over the man who was his enemy and how he died. And then we go to the Gospels and we see Christ, the Son of David, who did have God's own heart, who wasn't just after it, but who was it. And we see him weeping prospectively in anticipation of the death of his enemies as he wept over Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem! How often would I have gathered you as a hen her children, but you would not. Oh, Jerusalem, if only you'd known the things that belong to your peace. But now they are hid from your eyes. And he's seeing this awful doom coming upon those who are to reject him and crucify him and kill him. And yet, what do we find? We find him weeping. Genuine tears of sorrow and sadness over their spiritual destination. Do we not see here embodied what Ezekiel tells us? That God has no pleasure in the death of the wicked. And that means no sinful pleasure. Look at David here. There's no malice. There's no vindictiveness. There's no sadism. There's no cruelty. There's no contempt. There's no bloodthirstiness. There's no delight that Saul is dead at last and I'm going to inherit what is mine now. Take his position and his fame and his privileges. There's nothing of that. No doubt David was glad in a holy way. Here's an ungodly man been removed from the earth. That means God is less dishonored than he was while Saul's alive. That's a cause for gladness. Here's this ungodly example that's been removed from the earth. That terrible influence on Israel, that too is a cause for thankfulness. We have here a man removed, confirming the truth of Samuel's prophecy, and therefore his death vindicated God. So in these ways, an ungodly man removed, God not so dishonored, the example now not so awfully influential, and that the word of God had been vindicated. Yes, in these senses, there is thankfulness and there is gladness, but not in the death of the wicked, in the death that they are dying now, in the death that they are experiencing now. In the hell that they are experiencing now, David is saying, I have no pleasure in that. That causes me agony and grief. This is what we saw in Christ over Jerusalem. These examples give us insight into the heart of God, who has no pleasure in the death of the wicked. There's no sadistic, malicious, cruel contempt for any of his creatures, no matter how rebellious. There is holy anger, pure justice, unmixed with sin. And it's truly remarkable to read this. Weep for Saul. Use the death of the ungodly to affect your own hearts, to tenderize you, to sensitize you, to make you think about eternity and about hell, and to bring some kind of softening to your own hardness. This is what David is seeking to encourage and inculcate in Israel. Weep, weep, weep over Saul until you feel the tragedy. Until you're affected by this, until you realize the awfulness of what this man is now enduring in hell. And use that while you have time and life to seek salvation, to seek deliverance, so that when you die, it will not be necessary for your loved ones or your ministers or your elders to weep as those who have no hope. And to weep over you and the thought of you being in a lost eternity, suffering forever. Use your time so that when you die, yes, there is sorrow. Just as there was over Jonathan, there's distress. But not sorrow without hope. It's a sorrow that will come to an end in a reunion. So live that you shall so die, so that your death will not cause unmixed and unmitigated weeping. And only this can be found in Jesus Christ. He that believeth in me, he said, shall never die.